From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. In case you missed last night's Stanley Cup Game 7, or if you witnessed it but forgot who won because the celebrating or commiserating was just too intense, stay tuned, because the result is just ahead on Only a Game. Also, Charlie Pierce dissects the 2009 NBA Finals, and author Larry Tye joins me to discuss the life and times of American legend Satchel Paige. Also ahead, Kansas City Royals ace Zach Greinke overcomes social anxiety disorder and depression to earn a fat contract and a skinny ERA.
I didn't realize there was like a cure for what I had, to where I just hated being around people. Mainly mowing grass was my goal, to start up a good lawn mowing business and just do that.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Penguin is a villain in the Batman scary world, but not in happy Pittsburgh, where the banner is unfurled that says the Penguins there, by knocking off the favored Wings, have taken home Lord Stanley's cup and earned themselves some rings. Here to wrap up Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals is Helene Elliott of the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Helene.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Last night's game was an exciting up-and-down-the-ice affair, thoroughly worthy of its status as Game 7 of the Finals, but no moment, perhaps, was more exciting than the Red Wings' flurry that almost tied that game and sent it into overtime with 2 seconds left.
That game had everything in it. It had drama. It had, you know, the scrub emerging from the background and Maxime Talbot scoring the two goals. It had, you know, the superstar gets hurt and Gamely makes an attempt to come back and play again, even though his knee is probably in Ohio and he's in Detroit. And it was just great theater, great drama. Marc-Andre Fleury, the guy who couldn't stop a beach ball in his last game in that building. I mean, he loses 5-0 in Game 5. He didn't even finish the game. They yanked him. And here he is. He comes back, and he saves the Penguins' season, that great save on Lidstrom at the end. It was just wonderful stuff.
As I watched the players in the handshake line, I couldn't help but feel sad for Marian Hossa, who left the Penguins after last season's loss in the finals to Detroit, joined the Red Wings because he must have figured they had a better shot to win it all in 2009. How's he doing this morning, you think?
Oops. I think he's like asking the gods for a cosmic do-over, you know? It's like, on second thought, maybe I should have stayed in Pittsburgh. I mean, I feel bad. He's a very classy guy. But, yeah, didn't he make the wrong choice? And you know what? If you look at what he did in the finals and leading up to it, I mean, he's one of the reasons the Red Wings aren't the champions today. I mean, they scored one goal in each of the last two games. The Detroit Red Wings should score three just by stepping onto the ice. They should be credited with three goals. Their offense dried up. Their defense became frayed and worn and tired, and that's what had the Penguins were young. They were energetic. They didn't know you're not supposed to win a Game 7 in the other guy's barn, and they just went out and did it.
You mentioned Sidney Crosby, who took a hellacious hit in the second period of last night's game and played only just a minute or two in the third period before realizing he couldn't really come back and be of much use. Do you have any sense of the extent of his injury at this point?
I suspect we'll find out that his knee is either very badly bruised or dislocated kneecap or something like that. I mean, for Crosby to not be able to play, it has to be pretty tough.
Helene, as we've discussed, the revival of the nearly extinct Pittsburgh Penguins has been a remarkable revival. Does this victory, this championship, which is the team's first since 1992, bolster the Penguins' stability in the league and in the city of Pittsburgh?
Absolutely. I mean, they're building a new arena that's going to open in the fall of 2010. And I'm sure they need to sell season tickets and they need to sell suites. And it's going to be a heck of a lot easier to sell them now. I mean, downtown Pittsburgh, there's this huge banner on all the steelwork as you pass the arena as it's being built, and huge photos of Crosby and Malkin and Fleury. And I think they were their own best advertisement last night.
Detroit has probably suffered the most as a result of the current economy. As these playoffs have gone along, have you gotten any sense of how much this loss is going to hurt in the Motor City?
It really is sad here. you know, the last few years, it's the auto industry has been fading, obviously. The streets of Detroit, it's very sad, very grim when you go beyond the downtown area where the ballpark is and the arena is. I think that the Red Wings have had a long enough history of being at the top or near the top that it won't hurt them as an organization, but I think that it will take a little bit of time. People will be sad for a little while, and then they'll turn to the Tigers, and, well, maybe they can't turn to the Tigers on second thought. Then they'll go to the Lions.
Oh, dear.
Not a good idea there. Pistons, anybody? But that's a ways off.
Okay, just one last matter before we wrap this up. Who wins the 2010 Stanley Cup?
Oh, my goodness. We just got finished with this one, for heaven's sake. But the funny thing was we're talking to Mario Lemieux last night, and he was saying, you know, if we can find a way to keep this group together, you know, our core guys, our best players are 21, 22 years old. You know, Sidney Crosby's 21, Malkin's so young, Jordan Staal is 20 years old. He said, if we can keep this core group together somehow, you know, over the next 14, 15 years, we could really do something special. And I'm thinking, I can't plan ahead to next week yet, but he's talking 14, 15 years, and, you know, who knows if there'll be an NHL then.
Helene Elliott is Only a Game Stanley Cup Sharpie, whose stellar hockey coverage can also be found in the pages of the LA Times. Helene, thanks again, and have a great offseason.
Thanks, eh?
On Thursday night in Cleveland, Kansas City Royals ace Zach Greinke left the mound in the eighth inning with a 3-1 lead, thanks to a pesky Indians rally and a gull that refused to get out of the way of a 10th-inning line drive. Greinke earned a no decision. Still, the 25-year-old hurler boasts a record of 8-2, along with a Major League-best ERA of 1.72. Not long ago, a serious disorder threatened to knock him out of the game for good. Only a game's Greg Eklin has followed Greinke's career since the beginning, and he has a profile.
Stand with me, let's play!
Zach Greinke was regarded as a can't-miss prospect out of Apopka High School in Central Florida. 2 years later, he was in the big leagues. Greinke made his Major League debut in 2004 as a 20-year-old. That year, he won the praise of opposing managers, like Joe Torre, who was in the dugout at the time for the New York Yankees.
Greinke, I was very impressed. I mean, the fact that, I mean, you watch him warm up between innings. He's got a pattern. He knows what he wants to do, and he throws so many different speeds, and that's what, you know, that's what pitching's all about.
And Minnesota Twins manager Ron Gardenhire.
He's a very good pitcher in this league, and he changes speeds and moves the ball around, and he's very poised out there, so he makes it tough on you as hitters.
Greinke's 3.97 earned run average in 2004 was the best among rookies in the major leagues. By the end of 2004, the Royals finished with 104 losses, at the time the worst in franchise history. But there was hope, especially with Greinke's stock on the rise. He knew, however, he wasn't where he wanted to be.
Well, I mean, it's a lot tougher than you think it's going to be. You know it's going to be tough because you're facing the best hitters in the world, but you really don't know what it's like until you're there.
After twice giving up 4 home runs in a single outing, Greinke was doubting himself. On the heels of his final outing in 2004, I asked him about the toughest aspect of retiring major league hitters.
When you're not sure if you can get the job done and you make a great pitch and you're like, I couldn't have thrown that pitch any better and the guy hits it off the wall or a home run or just a single somewhere. And you know that you did everything you possibly could to get the guy out and you're still not sure if you belong. I mean, I still am not sure that I belong up here.
Greinke later revealed he didn't have any fun in 2004 or in 2005 when he made 33 starts and finished with 17 losses. After he left the Royals during spring training in 2006 and was diagnosed with social anxiety disorder, he took 2 months off, started on medication, then worked his way back from AA ball that summer. The Royals recalled him on September 19th. Buddy Bell, their manager at the time, wanted to handle the situation delicately.
I'm not really looking for anything in particular. It's just the fact that he's up here. We see him, we get our eyes on him, and, you know, hopefully he enjoys himself a little bit.
Greinke has never elaborated on his social anxiety disorder or his depression. Upon his return to Kansas City, Greinke said it felt good to be back, and he did outline his goals.
Just to have a good time and I don't know. That's about it. And on the pitch, good.
Obviously, this is a great day for the Kansas City Royals. And we're very excited to be able to sign Zach.
After posting records of 7-7 in 2007 and 13-10 the following year, the Royals signed Zach Greinke to a four-year, $38 million contract in January this year. On the day of the signing, Greinke did his best to put his life and career in perspective.
It's just a contract or whatever, but the main thing for me is how far I've come in two or three years, where 3 years ago I was in the minor leagues, 2 years ago I was in the bullpen, not capable of getting hitters out as a starter, and then coming from being so low in those two situations to being, after one good year, getting a really good deal and a chance to stay with Kansas City for 4 years, where just hardly anyone gets that kind of opportunity.
Greinke was also thankful for the treatment, which included medication and therapy, that has since allowed him to enjoy life as a big league pitcher.
I didn't realize there was like a cure for what I had, to where I just hated being around people. I just loved baseball and was going to get a job where I didn't have to be around people all the time, and just mainly mowing grass was my goal, to start up a good lawn mowing business and just do that.
With the security of a multi-year deal and the prospects of an improved team, Greinke has lived up to expectations. Through his first 10 starts, his ERA stood at 0.84. The last pitcher to boast an ERA of under 1 after 10 starts was eventual Hall of Famer Juan Marichal, who achieved that feat in 1966. It could be argued that Zach Greinke was the best pitcher in the game. Royals first baseman Billy Butler was in Double-A ball 3 years ago when Greinke returned to baseball. He has seen his development firsthand.
It's pretty special. I mean, the guy's pretty much taken over. I mean, he really doesn't even need his defense out there. It's the way he's pitching. I mean, you know, it's almost impossible to keep going at the pace he's going. But as long as he's going that good, I mean, that's unbelievable. And you know, we're fighting for him. We're fighting for everybody. I mean, everybody's playing for everybody, and it's awesome to see a guy like that show his true talent. And you know, he's come so far, and it's awesome to see.
Greinke currently leads all of Major League Baseball in earned run average, but he still rates Roy Halladay of the Toronto Blue Jays and Johan Santana of the New York Mets as the two best pitchers in baseball. Would he at least put himself in third?
No. You got to do it for 3 years. That's my thing. 3 years, and then you could put your name in and stuff like that.
In 3 years or less, Royals fans hope Greinke leads the team to the postseason. The Royals haven't made the playoffs since they won the World Series in 1985. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Kansas City.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Why did I eat all those mushrooms?
If you're a pregnant baseball fan, consider the promotion the Minor League Brooklyn Cyclones will be staging on Sunday, July 19th. Activities on Bellies and Baseball Day will include pregame Lamaze on the lawn, the pregnancy pitch, in which any woman in her third trimester will have the opportunity to throw out a first pitch, and the certain-to-be-popular water break, where the husbands of the moms-to-be will strap water balloons to their bellies and race each other. More sedentary fans can indulge themselves at the Craving Station, where tables will groan with pickles, ice cream, anchovy pizza, and other dishes said to be popular with pregnant fans. Any expectant mom willing to name her child Brooklyn or Cy gets a Brooklyn Cyclones season ticket for life.
My mood can swing. I can be high and low just like the tide.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, caving enthusiasts worry that they'll soon be batting zero because of zero bats. But first, in the NBA Finals, the Los Angeles Lakers are one win away from their 15th championship. Thursday night in Orlando, the Lakers beat the Magic in overtime, 99-91. Game 5 is set for tomorrow. We'll take a closer look at the series with Only a Game's Charlie Pierce in just a few moments. Meanwhile, the WNBA season began last weekend. The defending champion Detroit Shock shocked their fans by opening with a 20-point loss to the Los Angeles Sparks, but two nights later they beat the Sparks by 29. The Atlanta Dream finished a woeful 4-30 last year, but started this season with a win over the Indiana Fever. Atlanta's Shamiqua Holzclaw, who played previously with the Washington Mystics and the Sparks, is making her third run at the WNBA, a circumstance about which Sports Illustrated's Kelly Anderson recently wrote. Kelly Anderson joins me now. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be here.
In 1999, her first year with the WNBA, Shamiqua Holzclaw was the league's rookie of the year, which surprised nobody who had seen her play at Tennessee. She's been an all-star six times. What were the circumstances under which she left the Washington Mystics?
In 2004, Shamiqua left the team in the middle of the season without much explanation. And about 3 months later, she explained that she had been diagnosed with clinical depression. So that was a circumstances that had started when she lost her grandmother who had raised her. And then a couple other family losses kind of built up, and she just couldn't put the grief aside anymore, and it all kind of hit her in the middle of that summer of 2004, and she just got to a point where she couldn't even leave her apartment and finally had to seek some psychological help.
Holzclaw's difficulties did not end there. Tell us about what happened during the next few years of her career.
In the offseason after 2004, she played in Spain and then requested a trade from the Mystics. And the Mystics traded her to the Sparks. She had a pretty good season in 2005. And then 2006, more family troubles brewed up. And she actually got to the point where she left the team the following year.
Until recently, Shamiqua Holzclaw has been reticent about her personal troubles. Was there a particularly low moment for her?
Yes. At the beginning of the 2006 season, a lot of the family problems she'd been dealing with were mounting, and she actually had to take a two-week leave from the team at the beginning of the season. Her mom was going through some difficulties in a marriage. Her dad was not taking his meds, and she was living 3,000 miles away from everybody. There's a lot of pressure on her to deal with family problems, as well as her career. And when she came back to L.A., these problems followed her. And one night, she said she was so down that she actually overdosed on her antidepressants, and a friend had to take her to the hospital. She was very lucky. Nothing terrible happened to her. That night was an impetus to lay off the meds from then on and just devote herself to getting better.
What has encouraged her to come back and to return to the WNBA, given the problems that she's had in the past?
Well, I think she really needed a break, and that's what she took in 2007 when she left the Sparks after five games. And I think having two summers off and a couple off seasons playing in Poland were sort of rejuvenating, and she really missed playing the WNBA. She saw a great opportunity with the Atlanta Dream, and she had moved to Atlanta 2 years ago. So it kind of was a perfect situation for her where she could play for a home team and play with some people she knew. She really liked the coach, and it just seemed like the ideal situation. So she and the coach talked last December, and they worked out a plan.
Her performance on opening night suggests that Shamiqua Holzclaw certainly hasn't forgotten how to play. She got 21 points, but she'll be 32 in August. She's been out of the league for 2 years. Can she be as good as she was when she was making those six All-Star teams?
Oh, definitely. I think the one limiting factor for Shamiqua is her knees. She has had some wear and tear issues. She's got a bulky knee right now. She's had tendonitis in both knees, and right now she's dealing with a floating kneecap that swells up frequently. So I think she's the same player she's always been. I think it's kind of a matter of how much her knee can tolerate, but if she can keep that pain and discomfort under control, I think she should have a great season.
Let us suppose that the stars align and the knees aren't too bad and Shamiqua Holzclaw does have a great season. How much can she help a team that went 4-30 last summer?
Well, I guess you can say there's nowhere to go but up. I mean, she's not going to be by herself. She has a lot of last year, I think there was only one real veteran on that team. And this year they've brought, in the offseason, they brought in not only Shamiqua, but Nikki Teasley and Sancho Little. And they have some veteran help.
It's very early in the season, of course, but the WNBA season is very short, so I've got to ask now for predictions, because by the time I talk to you again, hey, it might be completely evident.
I would go with Detroit in the East, and I think Los Angeles, if they get Candace Parker back at any point this season in any kind of shape at all, she just had a baby in May, they are going to be the favorites in the West. And then I guess I would call for an L.A. championship.
Kelly Anderson's profile of Shamiqua Holdsclaw appears in this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. Kelly, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome, Bill.
What would you do if you learned that your sport of choice might wipe out an entire animal species? That's a question currently facing thousands of recreational cavers. A growing number of scientists think spelunkers may have accidentally introduced a disease into American caves that could push bats to extinction. Congress has recently taken up the matter, and now many across the country fear that caves could be closed indefinitely to recreational use. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports.
On a gray, drizzly day in Moriah, New York, Al Hicks hands me a hard hat and points to what looks like the most uninviting hole in the ground I've ever seen. It's wet, it's muddy, chunks of jagged rock teeter on the rim.
Whatever the heck you do, do not hit your head on anything in here. Stay away from the ceiling. Things like this, they fall on your head from 6 inches, which would really, really hurt.
Using a rope and simple rappel techniques, we shimmy through, dropping down a scree slope into darkness. Halfway down, somebody kicks loose a stone the size of my fist.
Rock, rock, rock.
Welcome to the world of spelunking. 5 minutes after we descend, we've left that rainy day behind. Our headlamps play over underground hallways and soaring caverns.
I'm hiking along a ledge, and there's a huge drop-off below, several stories deep, and there's also a kind of a cathedral ceiling above.
Al leads the way. He's a middle-aged guy, an expert caver who traverses the route by memory. We've been visiting caves together for the better part of a decade, but we haven't come to this old iron mine in northern New York for sport. Al's a biologist with the State Conservation Department, and he's here looking for wildlife. Caves are incredibly exciting places to explore, but they're also complicated habitats, full of creatures as exotic as anything you'll find in a rainforest. The ceiling of this tunnel is ornamented with tiny bats, their bodies the size of my thumb. But when Al reaches up to check one of the animals, something creepy happens. It falls at his feet. Since 2006, bats in the eastern U.S. have been threatened by a mysterious disease called white nose syndrome. The fungus looks like cake frosting on the bats' tiny muzzles. It scars their wings and drives the animals crazy. They're normally dormant in winter, but for reasons scientists still don't understand, infected bats are flying around in the middle of winter, burning up bat stores and freezing to death.
Seven little browns hanging there, and one, two, three, four of them have the white nose on them. So this is a new sight we hadn't confirmed.
In a couple of seasons, the fungus has ripped through New York and Vermont and most other northeastern states, spreading as far away as Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ontario, and Quebec. Scientists now believe the disease could travel as far as Florida and Georgia.
We have the mortality rates that we've seen so far. We potentially could lose them all.
Researchers say bats could go extinct across the East and maybe into the Midwest. They're calling it the most devastating loss of wildlife in North America in the last half century. As they scramble to figure out what's happening, one casualty of the disaster could be the sport of caving.
It is so exciting to go into a passage that no one has ever been in before. You are going to probably, you know, the last wilderness on Earth, unexplored wilderness.
Top cavers like Peter Youngbear compete around the world, carving out new routes, going deeper into the earth. Youngbear is the white-nosed liaison for the National Speleological Society.
When I first started caving back in the 1970s, it was a badge of honor to pull out the filthiest gear. You know, if you had brand new clean gear, you were the, you know, brunt of all kinds of ridicule.
But that filthy gear could turn out to be a smoking gun. Scientists worry that spelunkers might have picked up a few tiny fungus spores along with all the mud and introduced white-nose syndrome into American caves. Dr. David Blehart with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spoke earlier this month at a congressional hearing in Washington.
There's references to a similar fungus in Europe dating back to the early 1980s, suggesting that there could have been an introduction into the U.S.
The fear that humans might have introduced or spread white nose caused federal scientists to call for a kind of timeout for the sport in infected areas. Marvin Moriarty is Northeast Regional Director for the Fish and Wildlife Service.
In March of 2009, the Fish and Wildlife Service issued an advisory recommending voluntary suspension of caving activities in affected and adjoining states.
State and federal agencies closed and gated thousands of caves this spring, from Maine to Missouri, sharply restricting the places where spelunkers can go. Peter Youngbear says the bat disease has thrown his sport into a state of shock.
Folks in the Virginias or Pennsylvania, where it just was found this past year, they're not sure. You know, they're a year behind or 2 years behind learning what this means. This is, well, this mean we can't have our big festival or we can't go here and there. It's like, yeah, you probably shouldn't for a while. You know, you should probably call time out and see where it goes.
Not everyone agrees. Young Bear takes me to a cave near Plymouth, Vermont, that was gated this spring for the first time.
The gate was, the lock was broken, the gate pulled off, and the stuff thrown inside.
Young Bear says he thinks local weekend warriors did this, not true sport cavers. But in a controversial move, his organization decided to reopen some of the caves they own in the Northeast, including sites infected by white nose.
I'm disappointed in that decision.
Molly Madison is an environmentalist with a group called the Center for Biological Diversity. She worries that sport cavers could accidentally spread this fungus from infected caves here in the Northeast to sites as far away as California and Washington State.
I think we should be considering closing all caves across the country temporarily until we have a handle on how white nose syndrome is spreading.
Many cavers think that's an overreaction. They say there's no conclusive proof that their sport caused any of this, and they point to the fact that the disease is now spreading rapidly from bat to bat without human help. The truth is, this debate over the ethics of responsible sport caving may be happening too late. During a trip to another cave on Aeolus Mountain in Vermont, biologist Al Hicks looks across a chamber where he estimates there are as many as 20,000 dead bats.
They're piled. You know, any little depression, any bottom of the slope, they're piled 2, 3, 4 deep. You can't walk or step on them. If this is what we can expect to see across North America for all of our bats, then they don't have long.
The caving community has joined with green groups and scientists to push for far more federal funding to pay for white nose research. For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann.
You're listening to Only a Game. Last week, Charlie Pierce and I discussed the failure of LeBron James to attend the press conference after his Cleveland Cavaliers had been eliminated from the NBA playoffs. Daniel Jones, who listens to Only a Game online, thinks Mr. James might have been anticipating rude questions, and he emailed as follows: "If I were a star player, I might have skipped it too. Until the media behave better, I cannot fault LeBron for opting to pay the fine." Charlie and I also discussed the National Hockey League's dismissal of the need for new rules against headhunting. Charlie remarked that this sort of behavior drove Eric Lindros from the game prematurely, and that provoked a call to the listener line.
Hi, this is Paul Stewart, former NHL referee. Charlie Pierce made a call comment with regard to Eric Lindros leaving the game due to a hit to the head. That is incorrect.
On that scratchy line, Mr. Stewart backed up his contention that Charlie was wrong by discussing three plays during which Eric Lindros suffered concussions. He maintained that none of them involved an opponent's targeting Lindros's head and, in fact, pointed out that in one of the incidents, Lindros had been trying to deliver a check when he missed and crashed into the boards head first.
End of story.
End of story is probably right in this case. The guy's a former ref, so he likely knows more than most folks about the hazards of hard-hitting hockey. Don Becker, a WBUR listener, wrote to say how much he'd enjoyed the story last week about the high school bass fishing tournament. He closed his email by asking, how about an interview on the heartbreak of a rising young star who stubbed his toe on the dock and had to go on the disabled list and even do a few rehab starts at the fish farm? So maybe Mr. Becker had his tongue in his cheek when he wrote. Maybe. And finally, listeners from Michigan, New York, and San Diego, among other places, want to know about the music with which we ended last week's show, which one listener attributed to, quote, an all-male a cappella group. I'm not sure how the performers of Bound for the Promised Land, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, would feel about being characterized that way, but in any case, here they are again. You can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at AVFX.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Washington Nationals have had a tough spring. They have been spectacularly inefficient at winning baseball games, but that's just the start. In one game, two of their players took the field in uniforms on which the word Nationals was misspelled. The team's efforts to shoot sausage sandwiches into the stands misfired and showered numerous unsuspecting fans with meat fragments. And in a game last weekend, debris from the pyrotechnics display with which the ball club had been trying to distract fans from the team's ineptitude fell onto just the wrong spectator, District of Columbia Fire Chief Dennis Rubin, who has ruled that for the time being, Nats fans will have to be content with the fireworks generated by opposing hitters. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a book about one of the people I'd like to have had dinner with, had he been available. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The L.A. Lakers are up 3-1 over the Orlando Magic in the NBA Finals, but apparently there's no reason for the Magic to feel bad, Charlie, because after missing a three-pointer in overtime that would have tied Thursday night's game, Hedo Turkoglu said, we can't really be down on ourselves, and Dwight Howard said the same thing after he'd missed 8 of 14 free throws. I don't know. Is it maybe time for Orlando to feel down about themselves?
Well, no, but I think they'll get around to feeling down on themselves long about midway through the third quarter on Sunday, because I think that the Orlando Magic, having squandered the opportunity to make their mark and take this from the Lakers, are going to fold like cheap suits on Sunday.
Well, if the Lakers do win on Sunday night, Phil Jackson will pull ahead of Red Auerbach for the most NBA titles. He'll have 10. So do we break out the champagne or mourn the end of an era?
I think we all light up a cigar and toast Phil. Phil's been enormously fortunate with players he's coached, but then again, so was Red. So,
Chicago Bulls guard Derrick Rose has apologized for being photographed flashing a gang sign while a student at Memphis. And unlike most athletes, Derrick Rose is not taking the "I'm sorry if somebody was offended by what I did" route, is he?
No, he went straight for the "I'm guilty of being young, naive, and using poor judgment," and he's sincerely apologizing. Of course, he's caught in the middle of this academic scandal now at Memphis, too. Circumstances are developing where he's sort of squandering a little bit of the really goodwill he's built up during his rookie year. I think he'll be fine. This was dumb. Nobody knows when this picture was taken, but he's certainly not denying that it's him, so that's a good start.
Elsewhere in pro basketball, Tim Floyd, late the head coach at USC, resigned on Tuesday. I don't suppose this has anything to do with a current NCAA investigation into whether O.J. Mayo was essentially paid to play at USC, does it?
Man, Tim, don't go out of pocket for this stuff. Find a booster. I mean, there's only one way to do it. Supposedly, he gave $1,000 to a guy who was going to steer O.J. Mayo to the Trojans. This whole thing, I mean, this and the Derrick Rose academic problem at Memphis, I mean, exhibits 1 and 1A again of why having your major universities serve as vehicles of mass entertainment are just stupid. I mean, if they are, then just let them be vehicles of mass entertainment. Nobody in America thought for a minute O.J. Mayo was committing to Southern Cal for any reason except for the fact that somebody paid him to go there and he had to spend a year there before he could go to the pros. This is preposterous to me. I decline to be outraged.
That's a first.
Now.
With the number one pick in Major League Baseball's draft, the Washington Nationals selected pitcher Steven Strasburg. Will he sign, or do you think he'll want to play for a Major League club?
Gee, Scott Boras is his agent. I wonder how well this is going to go. he's apparently going to seek a contract that goes well past the $10.5 million that he got from Mark Pryor back in 2001. And I know we're all supposed to think that Scott Boras's influence is waning. Ha, says I. Why the Washington Nationals, who have so many problems both on the field and off, would decide to pick a pitcher as their number one guy and make him the face of the franchise before he's ever thrown a pitch, and thereby delivering their entire franchise into the hands of his agent, is amazing to me.
The Atlanta Falcons have officially cut ties with quarterback Michael Vick, so how soon before another team takes a chance on a convicted felon on home confinement who has not yet been reinstated by the National Football League?
Well, I think the shopping bazaar will wait until Roger Goodell pronounces himself one way or the other. I don't see a good reason for him not to be reinstated in the NFL, at which point you'll see five or six teams at that point. If it happens during the season, when quarterbacks start getting injured, you're liable to see a buyer's market here.
Charlie, it's time to get out your University of Alabama football media guide and mark a neat black line through 21 Ooh. Of Alabama's wins from 2005 through 2007. Those victories have been vacated because 201 student-athletes at Alabama, some of these were football players, received free textbooks in violation of NCAA rules. Wait. Athletes receiving textbooks? This is a bad thing?
The first scandal in college sports involving people actually getting the books, which is interesting. Of course, they peddled them and did everything else. But I'm thinking that maybe while they were waiting around to sell these things illicitly and pocket the dough, that they might have browsed through them a little bit and found, you know, I don't know, quantum physics sort of interesting.
Osmosis might have occurred.
Right through the covers. Yep.
Charlie, since we last spoke, Roger Federer won the French Open. He tied Pete Sampras for a record 14 Grand Slam titles. I don't know if you were paying attention to that particular tournament, but one of the very few athletes inhabiting the same starry stratosphere that Federer inhabits apparently was paying attention.
Tiger Woods was yelling at his television, apparently, and I have to admit, I've never yelled at my television myself during a tennis match, but he said he was pulling for him. They do commercials together and stuff, and of course, he was winning the Memorial at the time, which was a good thing for him. But I'm very happy for Federer, who looked like he was coming apart at every nail there for a while.
And finally, Charlie, I know how much you enjoy New World Records, whether or not they have anything to do with a recognized sport. And so I offer you the opportunity to congratulate Karen Davey, grandmother and Dolly Parton impersonator, and perhaps you would tell our listeners of her achievement.
If you were wandering through the Auckland Airport in New Zealand in the International Departure Lounge at lunchtime a while back, you would discover this woman singing for 48 consecutive hours. She broke the world record at 2:30 in the afternoon and kept singing until, believe it or not, her throat started to hurt.
That's hard
at 5 o'clock, and she stopped.
My throat hurts.
She was
now.
Only allowed a 5-minute break after every hour, and she could only pause 30 seconds between songs. I mean, do you think she scattered or did she sing all the lyrics? I mean, did you think there was a good hour worth of...
No, I think they were all Dolly Parton songs.
You can't do 48 hours worth of Dolly Parton songs. You sing Coat of Many Colors 12 times?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. And Charlie's new book, Idiot America, was number 197 on Amazon.com's sales rank list when I last checked. My own recent book was roughly number 576,000.
Ooh.
Only you can help close that gap.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The last letter that you wrote was on a blue piece of paper. That old feeling's back. The clouds are moving in. The beginning of the end is near. I fear your love has faded in the darkness. Seems I have no breath. I feel the blues moving in. I feel the blues.
When Satchel got to the ballpark, it was like the sun just came out. So said Jimmy Crutchfield, who teamed up with Satchel Paige on the Birmingham Black Barons and the Pittsburgh Crawfords, two of the Negro League clubs for which Paige pitched during the 20s and the 30s. According to Larry Tye, the author of a new biography titled Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, Jimmy Crutchfield's claim is by no means the most extravagant one made about Satchel Paige, who may have won more games than any other man ever to have climbed a pitcher's mound. Larry Tye joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here.
Once Satchel Paige began pitching professionally at the age of 18, more or less, nobody's still entirely sure, I guess, he started establishing the pattern that qualified him as the champion contract jumper of all time or as pro baseball's first free agent. Do you regard him as one or the other or as both?
I think he was definitely both. He never saw a contract that he wasn't willing to break, and he was so incredibly talented on the baseball field that he never broke a contract with an owner that the owner wasn't willing to give him another shot. And that's what made him be such an extraordinary free agent. Was it wasn't just that he jumped contracts, owners were willing to pay and do business with him, and that ended up raising everybody's price that they could demand, all of his teammates, be it Josh Gibson or more anonymous players. 50 years before Major League Baseball ended up incorporating this new system of free agency, Satchel was, in fact, a free agent.
Although Satchel Paige is known for his extraordinary durability, he did experience an injury that he thought might be a career ender in 1938, and the injury led to his association with J.L. Wilkinson, who owned the Kansas City Monarchs, as well as a sort of farm club that he maintained for the Monarchs. How crucial was the connection between those two?
It was crucial in a number of ways. Wilkinson rescued Satchel at a time when it looked like his arm was dead and that he'd never come back and be anything again. And we now know, while then nobody could diagnose just what he had, and Satchel gave lots of colorful stories, we now think that it was a torn rotator cuff, and he did what anybody does these days for that kind of injury. He rested it. He pitched very little. He was playing the field. He wasn't playing for part of the time. His comeback, while he dramatized it, was a classic case of a player doing the right thing. Satchel understood his body probably better than any ball player ever has, which is how he could get away with pitching just about every day, three or four innings, just about every day of the year, and do it for 40 years.
At one point, you write of Satchel Paige, and I'm quoting now, "Nothing happened to Satchel that was not worthy of a story." It's an intriguing thought. What are some of the most exceptional things that happened to Satchel Paige?
Well, one is that when he finally made it to the major leagues, Wilkinson, J.L. Wilkinson, who we were talking about before, was his patron saint in the Negro Leagues. In the major leagues, it was Bill Veeck, probably the most colorful of all the managers. And it was Veeck who brought him to the Cleveland Indians, who later brought him to the Miami Marlins and to the St. Louis Browns. And Veeck was intrigued by Satchel's ability to never recognize a face. He, one day, Groucho Marx came in and was talking to him and got an autograph from him when Satchel was in the whirlpool. And Satchel asked everybody, when Groucho finally left, who the heck was that guy? And he had no clue who most people were from the waist up. But Veeck performed a little experiment, which was he took pictures of about 25 ball players from the waist down with no identifying marks in terms of uniforms or anything else, and he showed it to his entire pitching staff. The best that anybody did other than Satchel was guessing who six of the players were. Mm-hmm. Satchel guessed 18. And Satchel had this extraordinary ability to know what was important. He might seem like a space cadet. He might seem like he was never paying attention. But to the important things, like how to get a batter out, he was an extraordinary artist.
You discovered that in 1936, the New York Yankees sent for Satchel Paige because they wanted him to pitch to a young fellow named Joe DiMaggio just so they could see how good Joe DiMaggio really was. This was 11 years before Jackie Robinson broke into the major leagues. How did that encounter go?
Joe was at the time 21 years old, and the Yankees weren't sure whether this guy was for real. So the way to test it out was to bring in the best pitcher they could find, Satchel Paige. And the first three times that Joe was up at bat that day against Satchel, he couldn't get a hit. The fourth time up at bat was in the 10th inning, a man on third, two outs, and the score tied at one. This extraordinary face-off, Satchel on the mound and DiMaggio up at bat. DiMaggio hits a hard one off of Satchel's glove. Satchel deflects it to the second baseman, who tosses it to the first baseman about 1 second too late. What that meant was the runner from third scored, and the Yankee scout, who was so delighted, telegraphed his bosses in the Bronx, and the telegraph read simply, "DiMaggio, all we hope DB, hit Satchel 1-for-4. Can I actually tell you, I love that story partly because of the credibility that Satchel's pitching had, but I also love it because Satchel said after the fact that this was, in a way, one of the sad things that had happened to him throughout his career. Mm. That teams like the Yankees would bring him in to test out their young pitchers, but when DiMaggio would head off afterwards to Broadway, Satchel would head back to Outer Mongolia and barnstorming in the Negro Leagues. DiMaggio said in later years that Satchel was the best pitcher he had ever faced, and he actually went on to say that Satchel gave him optical indigestion with his curveball, and as far as his fastball went, all the catcher saw was ashes.
Beyond what he achieved on the ball field, and of course that achievement was enormous, you give Satchel Paige a lot of credit for advancing the cause of minorities wherever he went. How did he do that?
He did it in two different ways. Some of it was very overt, and Satchel said any time he accepted a gig to go and do a barnstorming game in a town, he said, "I will only come if my fellow black ball players and I are given a place to eat and a place to sleep." And he was setting this condition at a time in the 1920s and 30s when that was just unheard of, particularly in southern towns that he was going to that were still firmly entrenched in racial segregation. So it was partly that overt approach, and it was partly by going out and doing these extraordinary things to disarm and then dazzle fans across America. And he brought the attention of the white press, and he brought the attention of white fans to Negro League baseball in a way that set the table for Jackie Robinson. There was one wonderful old leaguer who said, "Jackie opened the door to integration, but Satchel inserted the key."
Satchel Paige was well past his prime when he finally did get a chance to pitch in the major leagues in 1948, but he had some impressive stretches with the Cleveland Indians and then with the St. Louis Browns, although he didn't much relish the discipline associated with those teams and their managers. How many games do you suppose he would have won if there had been no color line?
Well, he says that he won 2,000 games as it was.
2,000.
And I initially thought that's
great.
Just totally off the wall. So I went back and started looking at the numbers. And when you look at the fact that Satchel pitched 3 or 4 innings just about every night, and when you look at the fact that he pitched all year long, and when you look at the fact that he pitched for more than 40 years, I concluded at the end that he was underestimating how many games he had pitched at and probably how many he won.
Fairly late in his life, Satchel Paige said, "Most people think old Satch is either dead or rich." He died at home in Kansas City in 1982, and I gather that at that time, despite all the money that he had made and the much greater amounts that he had generated for other people, he wasn't rich.
He wasn't rich in part because he had kids late in life, and he had 7 kids that he had to support long after he had filled his closet with suits, after he had 4 closets to hold those suits and 1 just for his shoes. He indulged himself over the years extraordinarily. So when he died, it was partly sad that he died without a whole lot of money. It was also sad that a guy, as you and your listeners know, who for all of his famous quotes was most famous for the quote, "Don't look back, somebody might be gaining on you," for the first time in his life, in his later years, he looked back. He was a bit overwhelmed by all the injustices done to him. He was upset that too few people remembered him, and he died far too bitter for a guy who spent most of his life incredibly upbeat.
Larry Tye is the author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, published by Random House. Larry, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with me.
Thanks for having me in.
Full set, say jangle when you move so the fat don't stick. Go light on vice and society. Never eat fried meats, they angry up the blood. Never run, never run. If your stomach disputes, calm it down with your brain. Don't look back, cause something might be gaining. The secret alive, secret of Satchel Paige.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurz. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Brian Mann's caving photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Satchel Paige biographer Larry Tye, who shares some of his favorite Paige-isms.
He said, "Don't pray when it rains if you don't pray when the sun shines." He said, "Ain't no man can avoid being born average, but there ain't no man got to be common."
How nice to be reminded of such splendid lifestyle advice. Eat your heart out, Oprah. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
June 82, said Josh, is that you? Josh said, "Satch, how you doing?" The boys is fine, playing like 1929. Playing ain't looking, playing all the reams. Playing right now against the white boys team. It's the bottom of the ninth, we're up by one. Josh give a little grin. They got a runner on third and nobody out. Satch. Now, Satch, that may sound as if we're in a spot of difficulty up here in this heavenly game. But that ain't the bad news. That runner on third is Eddie Collins. He's so fast, he can turn out the lights and be in bed before it gets dark.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.